cowpoke went riding out one dark and windy day. Upon a ridge he rested as he went along his way. When all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cows he saw, a plow through the ragged sky, and up the cloudy draw.
This is Dan Klingler, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona with Western Short Stories. Today, we will conclude reading from The Humor of the American Cowboy by Stan Hoig. This is a Bison book published by the University of Nebraska Press in Lincoln in 1958. I remind you that our stories are sometimes edited for recording. We will finish the chapter we started reading last week before concluding the rest of the book. This chapter is entitled Parlor Sittin', and it starts again with a quote from Edward Everett Dale's Cow Country. "Oh, dearest Mary, what makes you so cruel? When I come to see you, a ridin' my mule." It was the lack of women on the range that created what is known in cowboy lingo as the heart and hand woman. In 1890, a group of cowboys were killing out the winter months by supplying wood to the army troops stationed at Camp Supply in the Cherokee Outlet. One day, one of the men came back from a trip to Arkansas City with a copy of the matrimonial paper, The Heart and Hand. Since this was about the only reading material in camp, outside of can labels, which about everybody had already memorized, all the folks congregated in a tent while John Allen, an Englishman gone cowboy, read it aloud. The paper told about a short road to marriage, and how there was a man for every woman, and a woman for every man. All you had to do, it said, was to write in, and you'd get yourself a mate sent along pronto. This excited all the cowboys, because, to be sure, they one and all wanted to get married. All, that is, except Jim Pickens, who claimed he was a real first-class woman-hater. Everyone else, though, got real excited about the matter. Tall Cotton, a big cowpoke from Texas, stood up and announced that he thought it was a crying shame that there were so many nice girls and widows who wanted to get married and no good men in sight. Frank Ibaugh said he agreed, and that, for sure, he'd help to save one from a life of loneliness and misery. Coyote Bill agreed that he'd help, and a young fellow called the Salt Lake Kid, a Mormon from Utah, said he'd take a half a dozen big corn-fed gals from Illinois and Iowa. One waddy declared he would make a cowboy girl of his, and another stated that while he didn't know what he'd do with his, there would be a doggone big face-licking in camp when she arrived. They all took a vote on the question of getting married, and everybody but Jim Pickens voted to write for a girl and get spliced. Jim claimed he would have no part of any such foolish carryings-on. Everybody got busy picking out the ad he wanted to answer. They had John Allen write their letters for them, and it wasn't long before the answers started coming in. All the girls that answered said they liked cowboys and knew how brave and fearless cowboys were. All of them had about the same story. Each had been married to the meanest man alive and had to leave him, or the other way around. The cowboys agreed on the first day of May as the time set for the girls to arrive. As a preacher was needed from Dodge City, Kansas, 125 miles away, it was decided that all the women would meet there and all come down together. P.G. Reynolds of Dodge City had the only hack line to Camp Supply, and he wanted to charge $10 a head to deliver the women. But Ben Nichols, who ran a mule freight line, said he would deliver the goods for $5 a head, and since the preacher was a Methodist, he'd let him ride free of charge. It was decided that a big farewell bachelor dinner would be held on the 15th of April, and a meeting was held to elect officials, referee, master of ceremonies, program chairman, and marshals. Supplies ordered for the party included new tents, blankets, groceries, a 32-gallon barrel of snake medicine, a wagon load of bottled beer, and other articles. Some of the boys thought too much was being spent on groceries and not enough on snake medicine. The Committee on Arrangements decided that the wives should be entertained with a Wild West show, bronco riding, bullfights, and shooting contests. This would give the women a chance to see what real he-men cowboys they were getting. The day before the bachelor dinner, all the six-shooters, rifles, butcher knives, and axes were hidden. The dinner was a huge success. Even Jim Pickens agreed on that. The cowboys woke up the next morning asking, "How many men did I whip last night? Did any of the boys get killed? Is there anything wrong with my eyes? What's this old rag doing round my head? Who owns these boots I got on?" It took a week to get things in good order again. 2 8-mule teams and 6 wagons were needed to haul the women and their baggage from Dodge City. When they drove into camp and began to crawl out of the wagons, the cowboys were all falling over one another hunting up the ones that had answered to their names as the preacher called them out. 8 girls failed to show up, and when the name matching was over, there was a big fat widow with 6 kids left over. It was clear she had tagged along just to take pot luck, but nobody seemed to care very much. The cowboys talked it over and decided that the only fair thing to do was to put her up as first prize in the Wild West show. Jim Pickens had been standing to one side while all the shouting was going on, but when it was time for the Wild West show to start, he stepped up and entered. He said he didn't want any prize, that he just wanted to prove to one and all that he was the best cowboy in the Cherokee Strip. And sure enough, he was. He won all the roping, the bronco riding, and the shooting contests. And when it was all over, and he was the winner, all the other cowpokes agreed that he was bound to accept the prize he had won. They made him stand up and get hitched to the widow with the 6 kids. Perhaps it was the cowboy's disappointments in such affairs that caused him to be extremely skeptical of marriage. As goes the toast once recited by a cowboy at a wedding, "A wedding is the greatest place for folks to go and learn. He thought that she was his'n, but found out that he was her'n." Jim Collins of the Half Circle H once went to a wedding in company with another puncher. The bride was the younger daughter of an old nester, and the groom a gangling Granger boy. Jim sat silently through the ceremony until the minister came to the part about, "With all my worldly goods I thee endow." When the groom had repeated the promise, Jim nudged his companion and whispered, "There goes Sam Shotgun. Somebody stole his dog just last week." A drunk cowboy one night asked a girl to dance with him and was refused. He promptly told her where to go. The girl's brother was at the dance, and she informed him of the insult which had been directed to her. The brother caught the waddy and insisted that he apologize to the girl. The brother was big, and the cowboy wasn't that drunk. He promised to make the apology. "I take it all back," he told the girl when he found her. "You don't need to go to the devil after all. Your brother and me has made other arrangements." A cowboy was visiting a friend who had recently married and was having mother-in-law problems. The cowboy suggested to the fellow that they go out and drown his sorrows. "It wouldn't work," the friend said disconsolately. "She can swim." In Cheyenne once, a hefty son of the range became so enthralled that the coyote tremolo rendition by a blonde soprano of "The Last Kiss My Darling Mother Gave" that he hurled a $20 gold piece in her direction. It hit her behind the ear and knocked her senseless. Another western town was visited by a traveling show troupe, which included a concert singer. One cowboy was urging a buddy to go with him. "Is she any good?" he was asked. "Good? Why, man, she's a virtuoso." "To heck with her morals," the waddy snorted. "I want to know if she can sing." Tolly Sands was supposed to be the homeliest man, without exception, in the Guadalupe Mountains of New Mexico, but nevertheless, his wife, Eliza, was extremely jealous of a widow lady in town whom she thought to be after Tolly. So the story goes, a peddler one day stopped at their ranch and showed Tolly a mirror, something he had never seen or heard of before. He liked what he saw in it and asked, "How much for this picture?" He paid the price and kept it. Later, Eliza, who had been away gathering wood at the time, was snooping in Tolly's things and came across the mirror.
"So that's the sour-faced old hussy you've been chasing, is it?"
she said, and smashed the mirror over Tolly's head. Like Eliza, cowboys looked upon the vows of betrothal as serious matters. One Texas cowboy was engaged to a little girl who made a visit to the big city. While there, she wrote to the cowboy, telling him of the wonderful time she was having, and mentioning the modern marvel of having a hotel room with running water. It was but a short time before she received a wire from the cowboy. It read, "Get rid of that Indian at once, or our engagement is off." One old bachelor, a wealthy rancher, had a sister who lived in the big city, and who was constantly harping at him to let her show him the town. The old boy didn't care much for cities, but the day came when he had a load of cattle headed in that direction. He gave in and wired his sister that he was on his way. The sister was anxious to show him a good time, and had things all arranged, with dinner at a downtown hotel and a show scheduled for later. The lady whom the sister had chosen for him was the middle-aged, gushing type, and the old cowman didn't care much for her. After dinner, it was decided that they would walk 3 or 4 blocks to the theater. As they left the hotel, the cowman managed to slip a chew of tobacco into his mouth, and he and the lady friend followed along behind the others. The cowman's companion chattered away about the social life in the city, letting him know she was on the in with those who amounted to something around town. Finally, she got to what was strongest on her mind. "I understand that you own an enormous ranch with just oodles of cows."
"Well, ma'am, I don't really own all that, but I'm cooking for one of the biggest outfits in Texas."
The cowboy that got married was an exception to the rule. For the most part, he belonged to a womanless world. For the girl who married a cowboy, there was generally a hard, lonely life ahead. But divorces were scarce, unless, that is, you were in Judge Roy Bean's territory. Roy defended his right to grant divorces this way.
"Heck, I married him, didn't I? Then I got the right to unmarry him. A man has the right to rectify his own errors, ain't he?"
And that was Parlor Sittin'. This chapter is entitled Cowboy vs. Railroader, and it starts with a quote. A famous outlaw whose specialty was train holdups once wrote the Union Pacific and complained that they were running their trains entirely too fast for public convenience. One of the most interesting and certainly the most amusing rivalries to develop in the old Wild West was that between the cowboy and the railroader. From the time the first blast of a train whistle caused a range wild cayuse to toss its rider unceremoniously from its back, the feud was on, and there began the liveliest barrage of insults, sarcastic wit, and fun-making in the history of the West. To the cowboy, all railroaders were bull-headed Irishmen who took fiendish delight in stampeding herds of cattle. The railroader, on the other hand, viewed cowboys as irresponsible troublemakers who were constantly stringing their herds across the tracks merely to disrupt the railroad's all-important time schedule. Generally, both opinions were entirely correct. The thing which caused more to-do between the men of these two professions than anything else was the matter of cattle which were hit and killed by trains. The cattlemen always claimed the loss to be nothing less than a head of prime beef, while the railroad agents swore in rebuttal that the cowman had placed salt on the tracks so as to lure some of his market-rejected cattle into the path of the train in an attempt to collect from the railroad. Despite the fact that the railroad was vital in making cattle raising a profitable business by connecting it with the eastern markets, the cowboy blamed it for the immigration of settlers and homesteaders into areas which he felt were, by destiny, cattle land. Further, the railroad symbolized change and progress, a couple of items for which the old-time cowboy had absolutely no use. Deserved or not, the railroad bore the brunt of much cowboy sarcasm. The story is told of an old ranchman who had been the sole eyewitness to a serious train wreck in the Southwest. He was called upon by an investigating committee to give his account of the affair. The rancher's story went like this. "Well, I was riding along the backbone of a ridge looking for mavericks when I saw down to the south a train a-coming along about 50 miles an hour. Then I looked north and spied another coming south but about the same speed. And I saw they's gonna smack into one another at that curve. What did you do then?"
"Do? Why, nothing."
"You mean you didn't even try to stop them?"
"Nah."
"Good Lord, man. What were you thinking about?"
"Well, for one thing, I was thinking what a heck of a way that was to run a railroad."
Many cowboys, in fact, were firmly convinced that they were better railroaders than the railroaders themselves. Prairie philosophers spent much of their time in dreaming up suggestions and new laws which would stop engines from stampeding horses and waking people in the middle of the night with their whistles and bells. One agent, finally having all this he could stand, wrote to a newspaper with his railroader's sarcasm and suggested a law of his own. "Whereas, any engineer whose train has frightened a horse will stop immediately, take his engine completely apart, and hide it in a nearby ditch until the horse has gone on." Railroaders seldom passed up their opportunities to get back at the men of the cow country. Accordingly, an engineer of a train loaded with cattle, aware that the foreman in charge had never been aboard a train, began whipping his cinder wagon around the curves as if it were a black snake. The conductor of the train knew what was up and kept a close eye on the perspiring waddy. When the ears of the foreman had taken on a slightly greenish color, the railroader inquired innocently if they were going too fast for him.
"Heck, yes," the cowboy exploded. "I don't know about the gent that's herding this thing, but personally, I'd rather get to Kansas City an hour late than to get to Hades on time."
Cowboys had little understanding or sympathy for train rules, and generally did their best to break all of them. One waddy, while riding a train which had no diner, decided that he was hungry. During a stop, he climbed off and came back with a package. Shortly thereafter, the conductor saw smoke pouring out of the car. Thinking that the train was on fire, he dashed in to help save the passengers. But he discovered that the only thing burning was the steak, which the waddy was cooking on top of the train's coal stove. The conductor grabbed the steak and tossed it out the car window, losing forever any chance of friendship with one very disgruntled and still hungry cowpoke. Another waddy, on his way to visit his girlfriend, had bought himself a fancy outfit just before embarking on his journey. In those days, there was no men's lounge, and, notwithstanding the fact that there were ladies aboard, he proceeded to strip to his long handles and change attire then and there in the parlor car. He practically had to fight the entire train crew, but eventually he managed to get his new suit on and left the train with firm convictions about a railroad that would try to keep him from impressing his lady friend. The waddy who best expressed the cowboy's sentiment was tobacco-chawing Bill Jones, who was making a trip on a stock train. Bill was riding in the caboose, which was equipped with a cuspidor, even though Bill evidenced no real ambition to use it, merely snap-shooting in its general direction. When the conductor came in and viewed the results of Bill's tobacco, he angrily demanded that Bill use more caution in aiming at the spittoon. When he was gone, Bill loosed another barrage, this time with bull's-eye accuracy.
"That's just the way with them darn railroaders," he complained bitterly. "Get more doggone particular all the time."
Train riding to most cowboys, at least for the first time, was an adventure, and quite often a hilarious one. No better comedy has come out of the West than is to be found in Colonel Jack Potter's account of his first train ride, which appeared in The Trail Drivers of Texas. In the spring of 1882, Potter made his first trail drive, moving a herd on up to Colorado. The drive up was uneventful, with just the usual stampedes and Indian engagements, But the trip back home via railroad gave Potter more than his share of trouble. Here I was, a boy not yet 17 years old, 2,000 miles from home. I had never been on a railroad train, had never slept in a hotel, never taken a bath in a bathhouse, and from babyhood, I had heard terrible stories about ticket thieves, money changers, pickpockets, three-card Monty, and other robbing schemes, and I had horrors about this, my first railroad trip. The first thing I did was to make my money safe by tying it up in my shirt tail. I had a draft for $150 and some currency. I purchased a second-hand trunk and about 200 feet of rope with which to tie it. The contents of the trunk were one Applehorn saddle, a pair of chaps, a Colt 45, one sugan, which I think is a straw rope, a henskin blanket, and a change of dirty clothes. About 4 p.m., the Union Pacific train came pulling into Greeley. Then it was a hasty handshake with the boys. One of them handed me my trunk check, saying, "Your baggage is loaded. Goodbye. Write me when you get home." And the train pulled out. It took several minutes for me to collect myself, and then the conductor came through and called for the tickets. When I handed him my ticket, he punched a hole in it, and then pulled out a red slip, punched it too, and slipped it into my hat band. I jumped to my feet and said, "You can't come that one on me. Give me back my ticket." But he passed out of hearing, and as I had not yet learned how to walk in a moving train, I could not follow him. When I'd become fairly settled in my seat again, the train crossed a bridge, and as it went by, I thought the thing was going to hit me on the head. I dodged those bridges all the way up to Denver. When I reached there, I got off at the Union Station and walked down to the baggage car and saw them unloading my trunk. I stepped up and said, "I'll take my trunk." A man said, "Nope, we're handling this baggage." "But," I said, "that's my trunk, and has my saddle and gun in it." They paid no attention to me, and wheeled the trunk off to the baggage room, but I followed right along, determined that they were not going to put anything over on me. Seeing that I was so insistent, one of the men asked me for the check. It was wrapped up in my shirt tail, and I went after it and produced the draft I had been given as wages. He looked at it and said, "This is not your trunk check. Where is your metal check with numbers on it?" Then it began to dawn on me what the darn thing was, and when I produced it and handed it to him, he asked me where I was going. I told him to San Antonio, Texas, if I could get there. I then showed him my letter to the general ticket agent, and he said, "Now, boy, you leave this trunk right here, and we'll recheck it. You need not bother about it." That sounded bully to me. The next morning, I started out to find the Santa Fe ticket office, where I presented my letter to the head man there. As it was near train time, I hunted up the baggage crew and told them I was ready to make another start. I showed them my ticket and asked them about my trunk. They examined it, put on a new check, and gave me one with several numbers on it. I wanted to take the trunk out and put it on the train, but they told me to rest easy and they would put it on. I stood right there until I saw them put it on the train, then I climbed aboard. This being the second day out, I thought my troubles should be over, but not so, for I couldn't face those bridges. They kept me dodging and fighting my head. An old gentleman who sat near me said, "Young man, I see by your dress that you are a typical cowboy, and no doubt you can master the worst bronco or rope or tie a steer in less than a minute. But in riding on a railway train, you seem to be a novice. Sit down on this seat with your back to the front, and those bridges will not bother you." And sure enough, it was just as he said. That night, Jack arrived in Dodge City, Kansas, and found the town jammed with other trail drivers, and here he came across Jesse Presnell, who told him that old Dogface Smith and his crew were joining the train. Old Dogface Smith was a typical Texan, about 30 years of age, with long hair and 3 months' growth of whiskers. He wore a blue shirt and a red cotton handkerchief around his neck.
He had a bright, intelligent face that bore the appearance of a good trail hound, which no doubt was the cause of people calling him Dogface. I'll never forget seeing that train come into Dodge City that night. Old Dogface and his bunch were pretty badly frightened, and we had considerable difficulty in getting them aboard. It was about 12:30 when the train pulled out. The conductor came around and I gave him my cowboy ticket. It was almost as long as your arm, and he tore off a chunk of it. I said, "What authority have you to tear up a man's ticket?" He laughed and said, "You're on my division. I simply tore off one coupon, and each conductor between here and San Antonio will tear off another one for each division." That sounded all right, but I wondered if that ticket would hold out all the way down. Everyone seemed to be tired and worn out, and the bunch began bedding down. Old Dogface was out of humor and was the last one to bed down. At about 3 o'clock, our train was sidetracked to let the westbound train pass. This little stop caused the boys to sleep the sounder. Just then the westbound train sped by, traveling at the rate of about 40 miles an hour, and just as it passed our coach, the engineer blew the whistle. Talk about your stampedes. That bunch of sleeping cowboys arose as one man and started on the run with old Dogface Smith in the lead. I was a little slow in getting off, but fell in with the dregs. I'd not yet woke up, but was thinking I was in a genuine cattle stampede, and yelled out, "Circle your leaders and keep up the drags!" Just then the leaders circled and ran into the dregs, knocking some of us down. They circled again, and the new butcher crawled out from underfoot and jumped through the window like a frog. Before they could circle back the next time, the train crew pushed in the door and caught old Dogface, and soon the bunch quieted down. The conductor was pretty angry and threatened to have us transferred to the freight department and loaded onto a stock car. We had breakfast at Hutchinson, and after eating, were again on our way. Speeding through the beautiful farms and thriving towns of Kansas, we organized a kangaroo court and tried the engineer of that westbound train for disturbing the peace of passengers on the eastbound train. We heard testimony all morning and called in some of the train crew to testify. One of the brakemen said it was an old trick for that engineer to blow the whistle at that particular siding, and that he was undoubtedly the cause of a great many stampedes. The jury brought in a verdict of guilty and assessed the death penalty. It was ordered that he be captured, taken to some place on the Western Trail, there to be hogtied like a steer, and then have the road brand applied with a good hot iron, and a herd of not less than 5,000 longhorn steers made to stampede and trample him to death. Pretty soon the porter called out, "San Antonio! San Antonio!" And that was music to my ears. The first move on getting off the train was to look for my trunk, and found it had arrived. I said to myself, "Jack Potter, you're a lucky dog. Ticket held out all right, toenails all healed up, and trunk come through in good shape." Of course, cowboys made up a good many jokes about the railroad. A cowboy was supposedly riding a very slow train one time, and noticed every so often that the train would come to a stop. The cowboy asked the conductor what was wrong, and the conductor answered that there was a cow on the tracks. Again they moved on very slowly, and again they stopped. Once more the cowboy inquired as to the trouble. "Oh," said the conductor, "you remember that cow I told you about back there? Well, we caught up with her again." Another cowboy claimed to be riding a slow train and complained that he could walk faster than the train was moving. The railroader's answer was that he could do that also, but the company wouldn't let him. One of the favorite tricks practiced by cowboys when celebrating was to rope the smokestacks of trains. It was this that probably gave rise to the story of Peckerwood Pete. Pete was a prize roper. He seldom missed with his loop, and his horse, Straight Edge, was a wonderful roping horse. So it wasn't unnatural that when Pete heard that the Texas and Pacific Railroad employed cowcatchers, he was interested. Now, Pete didn't have any idea exactly what the railroad used cowcatchers for, but he was dead certain that he'd make a good one. He rode to town and asked for employment,
modestly giving his qualifications as the best cowcatcher in the state of Texas. Pete didn't know it, but he was telling his story to the conductor of the train which had just pulled in. The conductor agreed to give Pete a tryout and suggested he ride up the track about a quarter of a mile, and, when the engine came by, show what a good roper he was. Peckerwood Pete rode with confidence up the track, and by the time the train got even with him, it was gaining a pretty good speed. Straightedge was shy as a rabbit of this smoking, clanging object, but Pete finally got him to lay in close. Then, at just the right moment, Pete's loop shot true, Straightedge squatted, the rope held, and the cinches broke. And Pete? Well, Pete decided that he didn't care much about working on the railroad. Whenever things become dull for a puncher lying around a cowtown, there was always the railroad depot where he could find some sort of deviltry with which to amuse himself. The stories told of a cowpoke who rounded up a bunch of old newspapers and lay in wait for a westbound passenger train. When the train pulled to a stop, the cowboy began running up and down the station platform yelling, "Read all about it! Read all about it! Sin Bull has busted out!" The train conductor, always wary of Indian uprisings, came dashing up and demanded excitedly, "Where did he break out at?" "Up and down the legs and all over," the cowboy yelled, and doubled up on the platform in convulsions of laughter. On another occasion, a railroad office once received a telegram from a trail herd foreman requesting cars in which to ship some 2,500 sea lions. Railroad officials were amazed and wired back to the original dispatcher for further clarification of the order. The dispatcher couldn't locate the cowboy who had sent the wire, but another waddy read it over and grinned. He explained that the foreman who had sent the message had probably figured that his cattle had swum so many streams on the way up from Texas that sea lions was a fit variation of sirloin. One cowboy who considered himself a tough customer took things too far. He boarded a train one day without a ticket. When the conductor asked him for his fare, the cowboy pulled his six-gun and declared that it was all the ticket he needed. The conductor went on his way, but he returned presently with a rifle, which he stuck under the cowboy's nose. "Your ticket has just expired, mister," he announced and signaled for the train to stop. He let the cowboy off miles from nowhere, and one cowboy learned the advantage of paying his fare before boarding a train. George W. Saunders liked to spin the yarn about a Texas cowboy who boarded a train at Denver after having helped in a trail drive to that country. He walked into the sleeper with a bundle of blankets and asked the Pullman conductor if there was any place where he could bed down. The conductor said there sure was. The cowboy could have either upper or lower. The cowboy said any place would do for him, not knowing what was meant by the upper or the lower. The conductor continued saying, "The lower is higher than the upper. The higher price is for the lower. If you want the lower, you'll have to go higher. We sell the upper lower than the lower. In other words, the higher, the lower. Most people don't like the upper, although it is lower on account of its being higher. When you occupy an upper, you have to go up to the bed and get down when you get up. You can have the lower if you pay higher. The upper is lower than the lower because it's higher. If you're willing to go higher, it will be lower." When the conductor looked around, the cowboy had spread his blankets down in the aisle of the Pullman, using his boots and pistol for a pillow. A railroad company once received this letter of complaint from a dissatisfied customer. "Dear sir, 6:30 this morning, in going to the stockyards to feed at this place, another train run into my stock train on an open switch and killed two cows and crippled four, and the rest of the cows in that car is now all over town, so I got one car less, and few cows in another car is feeling sore, and some of them got one horn left. The crew of both trains jumped off and myself, so it was no one hurt. Was not enough left of the engine and one stock car to tell the fate. 8 or 10 of the Kansas cowboys is all over town picking up our cattle,
Wish you could see him coming down the street driving one or two of them cows. I think they got about 10 of the cows in a pen down in town, and they heard of 5 cows in a cornfield just a little while ago. So I guess they will get most of them back today. I'll leave here about 5 p.m. We'll make tomorrow market. Yours truly, Doc. P.S. This railroad ought to take charge of this whole shipment and pay for same. P.S. The sheriff shot one cow on a street just a little while ago. P.S. The cows down in town is making the horses run off with buggies and running all the women out of town. P.S. I think this'll cost the railroad a good deal in this town. P.S. The railroad they give me poor and sorry run. P.S. They run my cattle 40 hours before this happened without feed. How about that?
There were times, of course, when the cowboy-railroader feud was carried on physically as well as verbally. Some old-timers claim they can recall occasions when railroad trains left cow towns with hot lead pouring back and forth. Generally, though, it was a battle to the last salty comeback. And that was Cowboy versus Railroader. The title of this chapter is Grub Pile, with an exclamation point at the end. And it starts with a quote from Ramon F. Adams in Western Words, A Dictionary of the Range, Cow Camp, and Trail. The old-time wagon cook loved to tell the tenderfoot his favorite recipe for making cowboy coffee. With the greatest of secrecy, he would say, "Take 2 pounds of Arbuckles, put in enough water to wet it down, boil it for 2 hours, and then throw in a horseshoe. If the horseshoe sinks, she ain't ready." So goes the famous old prescription of the men of the open range, who reputedly spent most of their natural lives in a state of hunger. It was their belief that the best seasoning for any food was a salty sense of humor. Humoring the daily bread was a time-honored custom for cowboys, whether at home quarters, on the range, or off-trail in some fancy city restaurant. One cowboy on a visit to town saw a sign reading, "Snack, 2 bits. Square meal, 4 bits. Bellyache, $1. He entered the establishment and, when the waitress came up, ordered a dozen rotten eggs and some weak coffee. The waitress thought he was crazy, but the waddy explained that he'd had a tapeworm, and he'd be doggoned if he was going to feed it first-class chuck. The first stop for a cowboy in town was generally the saloon, but once he had washed the dust from his throat, he was likely to head for the closest restaurant to fill up on the luxury of either eggs or steak or both. Chickens were scarce on the range, and eggs were the one thing which the West admitted the East topped it in. Many a cafe biscuit shooter, upon seeing a cowboy crew hit town, would dig out all of his state's fruit, even before he heard the inevitable, "Keep mine bright-eyed," or "I'll have 'em dirty on both sides." Cowboys generally liked their meat well done, and the old cowhand who bow-legged his way into an El Paso restaurant was no exception. He ordered a big steak, telling the waitress he wanted it well done. But when she brought it, the meat was anything but burned. The cowboy asked her to take it back to be cooked some more, but she insisted that the steak was done.
"Done, heck!" exploded the old cowboy. "Out where I come from, cows have been hurt worse than that and got well."
Another puncher was told that the eating hours at a certain hotel restaurant were from 12 to 3. He was astounded that it took the town folks 3 hours to fill up, but he followed the custom. He ate for 3 hours and announced afterwards that he felt sort of satisfied and fixed up for business. Even further significance was attached to the matter of eating through the role played by the chuck wagon in range work. The wagon was the central hub of all range activity, the meeting place for cowboys during roundups and trail drives, and the storage place for clean clothes, valuables, and equipment. Captain of this cow country institution was the cook, better known as the dough roller, grub wrangler, biscuit shooter, cookie, and various other cowboy-coined titles. The average ranch cook was generally a waddy who was too stove up to capably handle the range duties, and all his culinary training had previously been done at atop a bucking bronc. Some noted range cooks, however, were in their own rights chefs of the first order, considering what they had to work with. From their chuck wagon kitchens came such famous dishes as sow belly, or bacon, and beans, son-of-a-gun stew, frying pan bread, and other Western delicacies. Because of this, the cook was accorded a certain reverence and respect in cow camp society. He was the ruler supreme of the grub box, and allotted to him was the special privilege of being as cranky and bullheaded as he wished, as long as he produced good grub. But for anyone but the foreman to criticize seriously one's own dough roller was to court trouble. A cowboy, who was well aware of this, forgot himself once and blurted out a gripe that the biscuits were burned, then remembered and saved himself by adding, "But doggone, I sure like 'em that way." The cook of one outfit had a reputation for being of a mean disposition and for demanding that the man eat what he prepared. And as one waddy put it, he would just bog down a few raisins in dough and call 'em puddin'. One waddy from another outfit dropped by the ranch early one morning and was invited to sit in at Chuck. The menu was flapjacks, and the cowboy downed the first stack in fine shape. The next bunch went slower, but the waddy, remembering stories he had heard of how mean this cookie could get, ate them all. When he had finished, he was amazed to see the cook bringing in another batch. The cowboy was stuffed, yet he feared that if he refused them, he might stir up the cook's temper. Finally, with the help of 2 cups of coffee, he managed to force them down, aware all the time that the cook was glowering at him from the door of the kitchen. The cowboy had just started to rise when the cookie stomped in and slammed down another platter of hot cakes in front of him. "Here's some more," the cook snapped. "But I'll go to Hades afore I ever mix another batch. I never saw such a darned hog in all my life." A lady tenderfoot once complained that a certain cook didn't even wash his hands when he baked bread. The cook overheard the remark and was very indignant. "Why, sure I do," he replied. "How'd I ever get the dough off'n 'em if I didn't?" There were a good many jokes told about cooks. One is the story of the 2 cowboys who visited a chuck wagon one day while the cook was gone. Being hungry, they proceeded to dig some food out of the chow box. After eating, they decided to play on the cook by burning a WE8 or We8 brand in the seat of the cookie's extra breeches. When they'd gone, another cowhand drifted in and helped himself to a free meal. As he was eating, he noticed the pants and before he left added another brand, Me Too. Now, it was common practice on the range for visitors to help themselves to the food at whatever ranch house, line camp, or chuck wagon they visited. The only requirement was for them to wash the dishes when they were through. But when this cook returned and found the messages across the seat of his pants, he felt that the limits of hospitality had been crossed. He took out after the cowboys, caught them one by one, and tied them, feet and other parts up, to a tree. Then, supposedly without removing the wearing apparel, he proceeded to make a brand of his own, YY, which in cowboy lingo means 2 Ys, and the cook's brand was 3YY. It was the cook's place to choose the camping spot on the range, and he did so with 2 factors in mind, forage for the horses and drinking water. Sometimes the cookie would have to drag the carcass of a steer from the water hole, and sometimes the hole would be rimmed by the telltale white of alkali. It was during a stop at such a place that a waddy rode up to the wagon and took a drink of water. The water was hot and tasted strongly of alkali. The cowboy was thirsty and swallowed the liquid, but, afterwards, he complained of its strongness.
"Shucks," the cook answered disgustedly, "you didn't even chaw it before you swallowed it."
On another occasion, a waddy from another ranch was joining a crew in Chuck. The menu was slumgullion, which is a kind of meat stew, and it was mixed generously with grains of sand. The home crew could not complain, but the visiting cowboy was under no such restraint. He inquired if someone had by mistake emptied his boot over the food.
"Look," the cookie said, "don't you know that the good book says that we all have to eat a peck of dirt in our lifetime?"
"Sure," the waddy answered, "but durned if I want to eat the whole peck at once."
Cooks on trail drives were quite often pestered a good deal by Indians over whose lands they had to travel, and who came up to the chuck wagon and demanded food. One hash slinger had had his fill of this, and, when the next Indian buck came up, he loaded the customer with dried apples, which he had salted heavily. When the Indian had gone, the cookie doubled up in laughter at what he figured would happen when his visitor reached water and drank his fill. Range cook Jack Martin was an outstanding character, as range cooks generally are. Jack's cooking was fine, but his drinking was even better. One day the foreman returned to find him drunk, with no food ready for the crew. The foreman was pretty upset about the matter, and let Jack know in no polite terms exactly what he thought of the situation.
"Well, what do you want me to cook?" asked Jack.
The question put the foreman in foreign territory.
"Oh, just a little of everything," he said, and went back to work.
When the crew came in for noon chow, Jack had one big pot on the campfire. It was filled with a conglomeration of food. Beans, rice, beef, currants.
"Just a little bit of everything," Jack explained.
At another cow camp, the menu became so monotonous that the crew threatened to kill the cook unless he made a change. That night, the cook rode to town and made a purchase. The next morning, the crew was greeted with a newfangled concoction called Jell-O. The boys had to eat it because there was nothing else. When the meal was over, the cook asked one of the crew how he liked the meal.
"Heck," the waddy grumbled, "I'd just as soon put a funnel in my mouth and run against the wind."
Uncle Ike Hubbard was once eating supper at a roundup wagon and was purposely doing an artistic job of complaining about the chow. Finally, he got under the skin of the cook, who asked with sarcastic sweetness,
"Do you think you can manage to eat them biscuits, Uncle Ike? Or shall I toss them out and try making a new batch?"
"Oh, they ain't so bad," answered Uncle Ike. "That is, if you put a lot of this butter on them so that you can't taste them quite so much. Of course, you can still taste the butter, but then I'm pretty strong, as the feller said. And anyhow, your coffee's weak enough to bring up the general average."
Often a good deal of rivalry existed between cowboys of different states. On one occasion, the crew of a Texas trail herd was dining in the house of a grizzled Montana rancher. One of the dishes of the meal was a heaping platter of carrots. When they came to one Texas cowpuncher, the waddy pushed back the carrots with a disgusted face and commented that down in Texas they fed such food to hogs. The Montanan looked up from his plate and shoved the platter back toward the Texan.
"So do we," he said. "Have some."
Two cowboys, Solemn and Squatty, were in the big city, but they had only 50 cents between them. They'd just delivered 6 carloads of horses and had not had time to fancy up any. Instead of their usual sweet selves, they looked more like a pair of real, woolly outlaws. Despite their state of near poverty, they entered a large restaurant and ordered a big meal. As they were eating, Solemn remarked casually, though in a carrying voice,
"Don't you think I done right, Squatty, to shoot that restaurant feller last night?"
"You couldn't hardly have done nothing else," Squatty agreed.
They ate the meal and ordered a second round. Between courses, Solemn idly twirled the cylinder of his 6-gun.
"That there feller didn't treat us right."
"Yup, he was meaner'n a sidewinder in a hot skillet."
The restaurant man asked if they would have anything else. Solemn said he believed he would have a pie, and Squatty agreed.
"That there feller brought his troubles on hisself,"
Solemn remarked over the coffee which followed the pie.
"Imagine him trying to charge us more'n a quarter just for one meal."
"Yup, he brung it on hisself."
The punchers topped off the meal with a good cigar each, then asked the restaurant man how much they owed him.
Would 20 cents be about right?"
Two other punchers were on a trip into Canada and had to make a long ride back without water. The weather was very warm, and so, on the morning of their return trip, Cowboy Bill told his partner not to put too much salt in their food. But the other was out of sorts that morning,
and said that he wanted plenty of salt, water or no water. All their food was in one frying pan, so Bill took a knife and ran a line through the grub, telling his partner to keep the salt off his half of the food. That made the other one pretty angry, so he put all the more salt on his own half of the frying pan. Bill's favorite story after that was to tell how his partner nearly choked to death for water that day, and how, when they finally reached a river, instead of stooping down to get water, his partner ran right into the river so that he could drink standing up. A favorite joke of Con Price, Charlie Russell's good friend, is about an old man who operated a little grocery store close to where Price's outfit was once camped. Nearby was a boarding house, managed by an elderly Irish woman. In those days, it was hard to get white sugar most of the time, and brown sugar was used instead. The brown sugar came in barrels, and when the weather was rainy, it would draw moisture, becoming quite heavy. And each time the old lady bought sugar, she would accuse the old man of putting water in it to make it weigh more. One morning, the old man saw her coming and quickly got a bucket of water. When she came into the store, he was standing near the barrel with the bucket in his hand. The old woman ran up to him and waved her fist in his face. "Aha," she said, "I've caught you this time. I knew you were watering that sugar." After that, the old lady never had another word to say about the matter, seeming perfectly contented now that she had proved her suspicions of the storekeeper. The story is told that at a ranch one Sunday, they were enjoying the delicacy of fried chicken. Unfortunately, the platter started at the far end of the table, and the waddy at the other end was forced to watch the best parts of the chicken disappear rapidly. As a fork stabbed into the last drumstick, the cowboy cursed in disgust. "What's the matter, Tom?" the owner of the fork asked innocently. "Don't you like chicken?"
"Oh, sure," Tom answered with deep sarcasm. "Just pass me down some of them there feathers."
Another story tells of a rambunctious old Texan rancher who made a lot of money and decided to crash the social world. But this rancher had a young son who was constantly getting into scrapes of some sort, and the old man tried hard to teach him some manners. Everything went along fine for a while, and the rancher decided to hold a big party in honor of the boy. He had the ranch fixed up until it looked like a funeral parlor on the day that the mayor was buried. He invited the wealthiest and best-known families in that part of Texas. The boy's debut was a big success until, during the dinner, someone made an insulting remark about the young gentleman. Immediately he jumped up and started for the one who had spoken. But the old man grabbed him by the seat of his pants.
"But, Pa," cried the boy, "you heard what he called me. You ain't going to have me let him get away with it, are you?"
"No," the rancher answered, "but put down that knife and use your fork." Old Hank Adams was up to the big city one time with money in his pocket, and he decided to eat dinner in one of the better restaurants. He was studying the menu, wondering which part of a cow critter was worth $4, when he overheard a dude party at the next table giving the waitress their orders. "I'll have a steak," one of them said, "and I'd like it rare." "I'll take the same," another told her, "only make mine very rare." "A steak also," said the third member of the group, "but just sear mine on the outside." Old Hank liked his meat well done, but he couldn't stand to be outstripped by a bunch of dudes.
"That's what I want too," he hollered to the waitress. "Just cripple him up a bit and drive him on in."
Two cowboys had been on the trail for some time and had not even so much as seen a jackrabbit for game. They were getting pretty hungry when they spied a turkey gobbler in a tree. They shot it, and only then discovered that it was a tame turkey. But, since the bird was pretty dead by that time, they decided that they might as well go ahead and eat it. They had made camp and were cooking the turkey by the time an angry farmer made his appearance. He caught the cowboys with a big hunk of the bird in their mouths, chewing away hungrily. For a moment, it looked bad for the waddies. Then one of them waved a drumstick in the air and suggested,
"Squat and dig in, mister. We got more Meleagris Americana than we can handle by ourselves."
The farmer was overwhelmed and joined them in their feast of turkey. Alias,
Meleagris Americana, a cowboy who was noted for his extremely wide mouth and for his ability to stow away Chuck, listened to his employer brag as to how the new windmill he had brought in was going to revolutionize the cattle industry. The cowboy looked at the tiny stream of water which the windmill was sending forth and shook his head.
Heck, he said, I could drink water faster than that thing throw it out.
A small wager was made, and the cowboy began his guzzling. Just then, the wind stopped blowing, and the water ceased to flow. The cowboy got up disgustedly.
Aw, no, it didn't have a chance, he said, and collected his bet.
An anecdote well known through the West at one time came from the dairy which Judge Roy Bean supposedly operated. It seemed that once business was so good that Bean was forced to water the milk in order to have enough to go around among his customers. One day a man came to him and said that, if it was all the same to the judge, he'd like to have his milk and his water in separate pails.
Why, what's wrong? Judge Bean asked innocently. You don't think that I've been watering my milk, do you? Well, the other answered, we found a minnow in the milk yesterday.
Well, what do you know? Bean exclaimed. That's what comes from watering them cows at the creek. Another yarn told in Texas for many years concerned Sam Houston, who was dining in some very fancy company. The general reputedly had a very heavy appetite and ate all his food very hurriedly. By mistake, he took a great bite of some steaming hot rice and instantly ejected it back into his bowl. He looked up to see that every eye around the table was on him. The general paused.
Many a darn fool, he observed, would have swallowed that.
And that concludes the chapter entitled Grub Pile, which takes us to the end of our book, The Humor of the American Cowboy, by Stan Hoig. Thank you for joining us again for Western Short Stories. This has been Dan Klingler, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona.
An old cowpoke went riding out one dark and windy day. Upon a ridge he rested as he went along his way. When all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cows he saw, a plowing through the ragged sky, and up the cloud he draw.
If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org, left click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then, under Programming Links, left click on Demand Podcasts. You can now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device as well.